Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes it pays to have more than one boss. Some will see the best in you, others will see the worst and make you fix it. Sometimes you just want one boss, say the federal government. And that's what the big banks wanted. Today, they got it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday, the 17th of April. Today, the nation's banks got some good news from the U.S. Supreme Court. It ruled states cannot make their own regulations for bank subsidiaries. From Washington, John Dimsdale reports the 5-3 decision is a blow for states, and consumer groups are worried that customers could lose some of their protections from predatory lending practices.
This case started in 2003 when Michigan instructed the country's fourth largest bank, Wachovia, to register its mortgage lending subsidiary with the State Financial Services Commission. Wachovia refused, saying that as a national bank, it wasn't bound by state regulations. Today, the Supreme Court agreed, much to the relief of Richard Whiting of the Financial Services Roundtable representing big banks.
This is a very welcome decision on behalf of the industry that clarifies that national banks can conduct business on a national basis without having to have the complexity of dealing with a multitude of state laws.
National bank subsidiaries have been growing in number and offering more financial services, from mortgages to used car lending to Medicare counseling. Consumer groups, including the AARP, joined the states in arguing against federal preemption. Jane Darista at the Financial Markets Center says state regulators have traditionally done a better job of keeping banks in line.
I am torn between my notion that it should be a good thing to have a single regulator at the national level and my recognition that pragmatically having a diligent state regulator is a much better bet.
For example, Darista says it was state investigations that uncovered the cozy relationship between student lenders and college financial aid counselors. When it comes to banks, she says, two regulators are better than one. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Last fall, a disgruntled engineer at Lockheed Martin resorted to a new method of whistleblowing. He put a video of himself on YouTube. He claimed the company was allowing shoddy work to go on in a $24 billion government project called Deepwater to modernize the U.S. Coast Guard fleet. At the time, Lockheed Martin said there was no merit to the claims and promptly fired the engineer. Today, the Coast Guard booted Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman for, among other things, building 8 cutters that had issues with seaworthiness. It's the latest in a series of developments suggesting the government may resume control of some defense spending projects. Elisa Roth explains.
Over the last couple of years, it's become more and more common for the government to hand over control of defense projects like Deepwater to the private sector. Advocates of the practice say it's a way to control the high overhead costs of developing new technologies, but critics say it's a cop-out. Danielle Bryan heads the project on government oversight.
You've outsourced the most important part of the decision-making process, essentially, to contractors.
It's still too early to tell how much it'll cost to fix the mistakes that were already made in the Deepwater program, and it's also unclear what the real impact of today's announcement will be. The government could take back oversight of the program, but negotiate with Northrop and Lockheed to actually develop and even build the new equipment. Bob Work of the Center for Strategic Studies says if that happens, not much will change. Still, he says, today's announcement is proof of a shift in mindset, and he expects to see much bigger changes in government practice.
what you would expect to see is both the Coast Guard and the Navy will build up the expertise, the in-house expertise, to do design of ships and also have a more bulked up or better management oversight capability.
Many in Congress have been complaining about delays and overspending on defense contracts. Today's announcement is a first step toward addressing the problems. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
And then there was this piece of the story that prompted so many workplace discussions today. Virginia Tech held a convocation to mourn the victims of yesterday's campus shootings. President Bush called it a day of sadness for the entire nation. Meanwhile, commerce continues. Advertising Age reports that within 24 hours of the crisis, media outlets from Inside Edition to the New York Times had purchased premium placement on Google keyword searches related to the events of the day. Keywords like Virginia shooting. On Wall Street this tax day, no refunds, nothing due. Details when we do the numbers. Here's a startling statistic. Foreclosures in California are up 800% from last year at this time. Today, the nation's two mortgage giants weighed in on the ongoing subprime mortgage crisis. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, the leaders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said they'll unveil new programs this summer to let many subprime borrowers refinance their home loans. But some in Congress say that kind of assistance needs to be bolstered by new federal oversight of lenders. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has the story.
The growing sense that many borrowers need relief spurred today's announcement. Fannie Mae's Alfred King says the cheaper refis being offered could attract lots of interest.
About 1.5 million borrowers might be able to take advantage of this.
It won't be a panacea. Struggling borrowers will get payments that won't go up as much or as quickly as their current loans. That could save their houses. But many refinancings could extend the length of mortgages, meaning more money paid over time. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank says Fannie and Freddie helped out today in a mess that's not of their making. It's true that means indirectly aiding lenders and investors who made risky loans possible, since helping borrowers means they can make good on those loans. But Frank says that given the size of the mess, that's a necessary evil.
We do think it would be better if the investors took some loss, but we are prepared to see that the investors, having taken some loss, get some repayment, because that is better than having foreclosures, which are terribly disruptive to the individuals and to the neighborhoods.
Beyond helping borrowers, there's the issue of preventing future subprime debacles. Frank says Congress can build on Fannie and Freddie's work there.
You now have people who are making many of these loans. They're not largely coming from banks. They're coming from people who are unregulated in some cases. And I do think there needs to be a uniform regulatory standard going forward.
One of the ironies of Fannie and Freddie's offers today is that loans they back for subprime borrowers already forbid most of the costs and provisions that are causing so much trouble. Yet somehow they've been able to make money on loans most subprime lenders say can only be made at higher prices. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
In Ohio a few weeks ago, the governor met with 11 top mortgage lenders to try to sort out the Buckeye State's mortgage meltdown. Ohio has the highest foreclosure rate in the nation. As more loans go bad, banks wind up with more and more property nobody wants. Cleveland and its suburbs are spending millions to maintain those homes. But come billing time, lenders are making themselves scarce. From WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito has that story.
It used to be that if a mortgage went bad, the local bank took back the house. And that local bank had to pay if the city maintained the house to keep up its resale value. But these days, just try finding the owner. In the 1990s, banks started bundling loans and selling them as securities to investment, hedge, and pension funds. Add that to the convulsions in the subprime industry, and you've got a noxious mix when it comes to Ohio's ability to recover millions of dollars. Cleveland City Councilman Tony Brancatelli.
There's been numerous mortgage companies that are going out of business, then filing over to a receiver, and that receiver is going out of business. And so when we've been trying to get attention, it's been difficult to even find these mortgage companies.
Take the abandoned 1950s home six blocks away from me. Here's who foreclosed on it. The Bank of New York Trust, UA dated 12101 EQCC Trust 2001-1 FO care of Fairbanks Capital Corporation. My new neighbor is the Bank of New York, right? The bank's Patrick Tatey says I'm wrong.
The Bank of New York does not physically own the loan. It's always the underlying mortgage servicer who actually owns the loan.
The servicer collects the mortgage payments. In this case, it's a Utah company called Fairbanks. After a $40 million settlement for illegal loan servicing practices and a buyout, it's now SPS Financial. I call them up. A lot.
Hi, it's Maureen Saito calling from WCPN. Good. Is Mr. Bullock in? Okay.
Hi, is Mr. Bullock in? Okay. Okay, thanks. Hi, it's Maureen Saito again.
There isn't anyone else I could ask, is there?
He never did call me back. Welcome to our world, says Ron O'Leary, who works at the Cleveland Department of Building and Housing. He says the city has stopped bothering trying to get through to lending companies. The city just calls the local attorney representing the lender, and even that doesn't always work.
The response that we get back is, we're several layers removed from the actual client. We try not to let them off the hook that easy because they're the only ones that we really know where they are, and we'll just keep finding them.
Just try getting an owner to maintain a home if you can't find them. What happens next is these boarded properties become magnets for criminals who trash them and gut them for any metal they can sell. That devastates resale value. Larry Litton Jr., a loan servicer in Dallas, says lenders are stuck. Even if a property had some resale value, there's virtually no market for it.
There's some markets whenever you sell real estate, the only buyers may be investors. That perpetuates the problem because an investor buys a house, they put a tenant in the house may not get fixed up, becomes a cycle.
As the homes decay, owners listed on the deed are getting dragged into court for violating city codes. But Judge Raymond Pianca says he's repeatedly calling in owners who lost their homes in foreclosure and are now long gone. That's because the real owners don't want to be found. After foreclosing, lenders are taking months and even years to file deeds. That, Pianca says, lets them duck tax and maintenance bills.
We've seen banks and mortgage companies hold off on filing the deeds until they find a buyer. Then all of a sudden, all the deeds are filed in the same day, and it's a detriment.
Meanwhile, Cleveland is floating a $6 million bond to tear down hundreds of dangerous abandoned homes. Councilman Tony Brancatelli says that's only a fraction of what's needed, and it's time for lenders who made billions on Wall Street selling those subprime loans to step up to the plate.
They need to come to the table and make us whole, and they need to help recover from the problems that they created.
At the end of 2006, absentee owners owed Cleveland $4 million for cutting grass and boarding up homes. Officials say banks owe most of that. Lenders say the city needs to do a better job of figuring out the real owner. Cuyahoga County Treasurer Jim Rokakis doubts taxpayers will ever see much of that money.
And I think you're going to begin to see some of these companies making a decision, an economic one, to walk away. How much more do you invest? At the end of the day, all you're going to have is a vacant lot in a city like Cleveland or Detroit or Cincinnati, or take your pick of Midwestern cities where this is happening.
In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Marketplace.
Coming up, the sun shines on Germany.
This shows how much even Germany or even northern parts of Europe, how much solar energy we have and what huge potential. We just have to use it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some mixed economic news left the market split this tax Tuesday. The Dow filed up 52 points, 0.4%, and the day at 12,773. The Nasdaq deducted a point, finishing basically flat at 2516. The S&P added 3 points, 0.2%, to finish at 1471. A singularly bad day for Washington Mutual. The banking giant said quarterly profits plunged 20%, mostly because of losses from its mortgage lending unit. Shares toppled almost 1.5%. Coca-Cola's magic number is apparently zero. Coke's quarterly earnings were looking effervescent, mostly thanks to sales of the new diet soda. Coke's shares fizzed up more than 2.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.68%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now.
Thank you.
Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee discusses reducing the tax gap. The newly formed House Select Energy Independence and Global Warming Committee convenes a hearing. And lawmakers are scheduled to meet with President Bush to try to come to an agreement on funding for the Iraq War. One strongly disputed issue is setting a timetable for troops to return home. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. If there's one good thing to come out of this weekend's nor'easter, it's this. Uncle Sam is giving some of you a break. The IRS says anyone directly affected by the storm has an extra 2 days to file their tax returns. For the rest of us, the deadline is midnight tonight. No matter who gets to file when, commentator Martha Burke says half of us always get the short end of the stick.
Remember Ward and June Cleaver, your typical tax-paying couple of the 1950s? Ward went to work every day and June cleaned the house and cared for the kids. The tax system back then was devised by men just like Ward, those with stay-at-home wives. And it discouraged half the population, women, from working outside the home. Trouble is, we're still living with that old tax structure, and it punishes today's women, most of whom work. First, there's the marriage penalty. Simply put, if June takes the plunge and lands a good full-time job, she and Ward pay more than two single workers. Her extra dollars are taxed at a higher rate. If June stays home or only works part-time, her family pays less than it would if she and Ward were both single. But both outcomes pressure June not to take a job. Part-time work isn't worth it after the litany a woman hears about the taxes, the wear and tear on the car, and the child care expenses, something that men never seem to assess against their own incomes. And for every year she doesn't work, June gets a big fat zero in her main retirement account, Social Security. That means a meager payout in old age. So, married women get a double whammy. The income tax system pushes them toward home and hearth, and the Social Security system punishes them for it. Let's get marriage out of the tax system. Like most of Western Europe, we need to treat each adult worker as an individual. That way, each family could make its decision about who works and how much on the basis of something other than tax policy, something like whether they need the money, whether both enjoy working or want to build a career. Most families now need two incomes. Why punish them with a tax system from the last century? Ward and June Cleaver don't live here anymore.
Martha Burke is money editor for Ms. Magazine. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org. You've heard the number before, and we'll say it again. 46 million Americans have no health insurance. 7 million of those are between the ages of 50 and 64, old enough to be considering retirement, but too young for Medicare. Well, today the AARP announced a plan to reach that group. Glenn Melnick is an economist with the RAND Corporation and director of the Center for Health Policy and Management at the University of Southern California. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about the current crisis facing people in the age bracket of 50 to 64. We often hear about overall numbers. What about the folks in this mid-level here?
The 50 to 64 age range is part of a larger group of folks in America who are at risk of losing or are losing health insurance coverage. The folks in that age range are seeing employers who historically have guaranteed insurance for the years after they retire but before they're eligible for Medicare, we see employers pulling back and taking away that coverage. So unfortunately, this is a growing segment of uninsured or underinsured in America.
So what does the AARP announcement today mean for those people? What will they get?
It's potentially an important announcement. It's a joint venture with Aetna, which is a large health plan, and they're actually committed to designing and implementing by January 1, 2008, a new product which will be made available to individuals in the age 50 to 64 who are members of AARP, and there's 18 million AARP members who are age 50 to 64. So this potentially brings a new solution to the difficult problem of folks in that age range getting health insurance coverage as an individual.
Will this be able to alleviate the problem?
That will be the challenge. The difficulty in this age range of 50 to 64 is that's the time in life where people start to have significant health problems. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, becomes a potentially expensive population. And, you know, there's only two ways that the health plans will be able to handle that. One is by designing benefit packages that reduce spending, or the other is to try to charge higher amounts for folks who seem to be higher risk. And it'll be interesting to see how they mix those two approaches to come up with an affordable product for this population.
Let's talk briefly about the other announcement that the AARP made today, which is that it's going to be offering an HMO to Medicare recipients.
Well, that's right. It's actually a continuation of an existing agreement between United Healthcare and AARP to jointly market the Medicare Advantage product, which is an HMO, to the Medicare population. And there's a couple of significant features about this new agreement. One is it's a 7-year contract between the two organizations. But as part of that, United Healthcare has agreed when they sell an insurance product to an AARP member, they guarantee that they can be enrolled for at least 2 years. And that's important because the Medicare HMO program over the years has seen periods where large companies have decided they no longer want to serve a particular area and they pull out or withdraw from that area fairly quickly. And what this agreement does is it protects its members by saying, if you sign up, you know for sure we're going to be here for at least 2 years.
Glenn Melnick is an economist and health policy expert with the RAND Corporation. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
We get a lot of sunshine here in Los Angeles. Okay, maybe not today, but certainly more often than not. So it's not surprising that California is the world's third largest market for solar power. Japan comes in second, and the number one market for solar power? Sunny Germany? Yes, Germany. And as Kyle James tells us, all that solar power brings a ray of economic sunshine to financially challenged parts of the European nation.
If Germany has a soundtrack, then it includes the purr of high-performance BMW engines and the sound of good beer from a tap. But too often, the background noise also includes this. Rain bouncing off my umbrella, and lots of it, with heavy clouds and a general daylight level that makes you suspect someone turned down the sky's dimmer switch. Henna Weidhune is with Solar Praxis, a company that follows Germany's solar sector. He says while solar energy potential in the Sahara is about 2,000 kilowatt hours per square meter per year, Germany manages a respectable 1,000.
This shows how much even Germany or even northern parts of Europe, how much solar energy we have and what huge potential. We just have to use it.
There are a few reasons why Germany's taken the solar lead. Germans are pretty environmentally conscious. The Green Party is strong. And in 2000, lawmakers committed the country to at least doubling the percentage of renewable energy in the overall supply by 2010. With generous rates for renewable energy providers who feed into the electricity grid, there's a healthy market for solar power. And that market is booming, to the tune of about $5 billion last year. Its light is shining especially sweetly on the former communist East. Workmen are busy putting in machines that will manufacture solar modules at a new plant being built by the green energy company Conergy outside the town of Frankfurt under Oder. This is not the Frankfurt of banking and finance. This Frankfurt is on the Polish border and symbolizes the woes of eastern Germany after the Berlin Wall fell. Inefficient eastern factories closed, jobs vanished, and the city lost around one-third of its population. So this plant and two other solar firms that want to set up shop here, including an American one, are providing a glimmer of hope. Andreas von Brandemir is the Conergy plant director.
We, for example, had a job forum in December. Afterwards, we had 5,000 people applying for a job in our factory. The HR people had a lot to do.
Especially since there were only 100 jobs on offer. But those numbers are expected to go up dramatically.
I just read an article that in the renewable energies in Germany, we will in 2015 employ more people than in the car industry today. That this discussion is starting shows already how important this industry will become.
Eastern Germany is attracting so many solar players that it's been dubbed, well, it was inevitable, Solar Valley. Wages here are lower than in Western Germany. The infrastructure is excellent because of massive investment after reunification. And Frankfurt under Oder was where East Germany's semiconductor industry was based, so there's a skilled workforce. Andreas Kritzky used to work in that industry. He was out of a job for years before starting at Conergy 2 weeks ago.
There's new excitement here. You notice it in the population. The recovery that was announced all those years ago is finally coming. Now a lot of people are sending in applications and, like I did, looking on the internet to find out all they can about solar energy.
But there are still hurdles to be jumped. Price is the big one. Solar power can cost twice what energy from traditional sources does, according to Hinne Weithöne of Solar Praxis.
Price reduction is the biggest task within the whole solar industry, that they become competitive even with nuclear energy, with coal-powered plants.
Germany is counting on its technological prowess to improve the technology and cut costs. It hopes to export about half of what it produces to sunny spots like Spain or even California. In Frankfurt under Oder, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, understanding the advantage of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, experiencing a sales slump? Hire a playwright to help you promote yourself. That's what Ford Motor Company did. Tonight, as you all tune in to American Idol to see Sanjaya's latest do, you'll also see a new commercial from David Mamet that compares Ford's Edge crossover vehicle to rival cars from BMW and Lexus. Until then, we'll leave you with this from Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing.
Ford can only hope its own sales execs are listening. And that's how we close Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 52 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ lost a point, closing basically flat. The S&P 500, for its part, rose 3 points, 0.2%. Thanks to Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time, Vermont reflects on the ski season that was or wasn't.
For us, snow is the equivalent of the tech boom to California. I mean, it's not just skiers coming in here buying tickets and jumping on mountains. So it's hard to estimate the impact. It is huge.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.